You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet.
And story is everything.
We're your hosts, Jim and Bobby Bell.
And we are back from an amazing conference last week. We attended the Western Writers of America conference, and we met so many authors. We're so excited that many of them will be with us in the months to come, weeks to come. And that was the Hot Texas Swing Band, our good friend Alex Dormont, yeah, and the Hot Texas Swing Band out of Texas. We thank them for our opening and closing music. Jim, who is our guest tonight?
You know, a special guest tonight, the writing team, Andrews and Wilson.
Oh.
And we're going to talk about their book, Dempsey.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, no, go ahead. We're excited. Go ahead, Jim.
We have a short bio here. I'm sure the fellows will more than happy complete a lot of other things they've done. Navy veterans Brian Andrews and Jeffrey Wilson, known as Andrews and Wilson, are the writing team between WSJ, Audible, and number one Amazon best-selling Tier 1 series, which has been optioned for television, of which their latest novel, Dempsey, is the seventh installment. Brian is a nuclear engineer and park leadership fellow who served as an officer on a fast attack submarine. Jeff is a vascular surgeon and jet pilot who served with an East Coast-based SEAL team and later worked in COVID government task forces. They are authors of more than 25 novels,
amazing,
multiple short stories, and have sold millions of copies across multiple media channels. My gosh, guys, when do you have time to breathe?
I don't do that. Do you sleep?
No. We take turns sleeping.
Well, we are so delighted to have you with us. Yeah. And we're going to talk about the book in a few moments. But I have to say right off the bat, oh, my gosh, I have to read this whole series. The challenge is we have a commitment to read a book a week, so it's hard to go and read anything else. But to our readers and listeners that are with us tonight, if you have not read this series, you have to have every single one of them. And this is book 7, right? Is that right?
Yeah,
that's right.
And it answers some questions at the end of book 6, if I understand. I have to read book 6, but the end of book 6, is that right?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
All right. Well, we'll get into that more when we actually get into this book. But I couldn't put it down, and I hadn't read the other books, and it didn't matter. And my other thing I'll say right off the bat is avoid Russian prison at all cost. Well, Brian, why don't you first just tell us a little bit more about yourself, and then Jeff, if you'll follow up on that.
Sure.
Well, I think the bio is a nice primer to sort of my background. I'm a Navy veteran and also an entrepreneur. So I started my own business after I got out of the Navy. But, you know, that 5 years where I served as an officer on a fast attack nuclear submarine in the Pacific, it really informed, you know, just my character and my writing. And it's funny because I met Jeff at a writer's conference back in like 2011 or 2012. I can't remember the exact year now. It's been a while. But, you know, we immediately gravitated to each other. And we sort of laugh about it now because it's like, you know, just randomly at a cocktail party. Of course, the two Navy guys sort of run into each other and we hit it off right away. So, you know, I think that's kind of important for everybody who's listening to know about us, is that, you know, the sort of the same ethos of, you know, teamwork and carrying the load together. That's a very military focused attitude, and we sort of bring that to our writing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's no question that that's what bonded us together as co-authors was the friendship we formed early on and that ethos of team and mission before self that's bred into both of us. I'm now in Tampa, Florida, live 1,000 miles away from Brian, which is good because as best friends, we'd never get any work done if we lived in the same town. But my story is a little bit different. I'm certainly not a nuclear engineer, and I've done 1,000 things, as you read in my bio. Brian always gives me a hard time. He says, you got to tone the bio down because it sounds like fiction. But I've done a lot of things in terms of my Navy career. I served in the Navy briefly, then left, did some work for other parts of the federal government. And then later, in an effort to pursue a life of peace, I went to medical school and became a surgeon. I was in training when 9/11 happened. And like so many people, it made me angry. And so I went back on active duty in the Navy and had the opportunity to serve as a combat surgeon with the Marines. And while I was down range serving with them, I ran into some folks from the spooky side of my past, I guess. And I wound up working with the JSOC element of special warfare and did that for several years and then other things after that. So, my path is a little circuitous. I've done a lot of strange things, but writing with my best friend is certainly the highlight of the myriad of careers that I've had. Yeah. Being able to wake up and do something I love and do it with a guy who shares my philosophy and my dedication to family, my dedication to country, all those things, that's a real blessing. So
I made a note here. It's kind of like Superman writing about Superman.
Oh, that could be your tagline.
Yes.
Of all you fellas, what you've done, you must be about 75 years old, right?
It's you know, Jim, it's funny that you say that because we say all the time, we write a lot of stuff. But we're known for military covert operations thrillers. Now we're doing more with techno thrillers, near future sci-fi and stuff like that. But if you're into thrillers, covert ops, military, that sort of thing, there's never been a better time to be a reader than there is right now. After 20 years of sustained, warfare as a country, we have produced some amazing writers with that background. When we talked on the phone before, we mentioned some of them, Don Bentley and Josh Hood, whose book The Guardian just came out. Mark Cameron, who is an amazing author who preceded us in the Jack Ryan series and was with the U.S. Marshals. A.J. Tata, who was a brigadier general and now writes thrillers. There's so many people that have sort of been there, done that, that it's not about the technical stuff. Like, you can research that. Tom Clancy, who never served, obviously, what an amazing writer. But he had to work and research the tech. But what you can't research is the relationships. You can't research the human toll, for lack of a better term, the jackassery that occurs on a helicopter when you're going into a hot landing zone. Just that there's some gritty realism in everybody's work now because they've really experienced it firsthand. So I think that's a real something that we bring to it, but it's not unique to us. There's a number of us out here now that have veteran status that are writing in the space.
Mm-hmm. I think as a reader and not living in that world at all, ever in any way, shape or form, even the way that you describe how someone changes their breathing, how they adjust their whole, take control of their adrenaline, their heartbeat. I mean, if we watch the Olympics, we hear that when they talk about, certain things as they're getting ready to shoot a firearm or something. But, it's not until you really, I felt like I'm doing the same thing. I'm trying to be right with Elizabeth or be, right with Dempsey. And I think that's a real talent in the craft of how you bring that sort of data, dry data, but make it really real for all of us that haven't a clue.
We take that as a great compliment because, having been a nuclear engineer, I used to think that was maybe the hardest thing in the world to do. But now that we're doing this job, I realize it's not, trying to find a way to tell a story so that anybody can pick up that book, whether they've served or not served, male or female, regardless of your age or education level or background or interests, we try very hard to tell a story so that when you start turning the pages, like you said, you know, Bobby, you feel like you're with the character. Like we kind of use that tick on a hound metaphor. It's like you're along for the ride, but you're dug in. You're dug in. You're real tight. You're going along.
I wanted out of that IK 2 prison. IK or LK.
You got caught up in that thing.
Oh
didn't
my
you?
Gosh. Well, you know, sometimes a reader can say, "Oh, I can't read that." Just like if you're watching on the screen, you look away, knowing from the music, you'll know when it's you can come back again. and sometimes with a reader, as a reader, you may like, okay, I don't need all that gore, or you know, but I didn't want to miss a thing. That's how I felt. I wanted to be, and I think that the tough scenes, you still write them with great. They're not, even the tough scenes aren't really gruesome and you know, it's a thriller.
Well, that's a real compliment too, Bobby. And I'll tell you why, because I think one of the things that about Andrews and Wilson that is perhaps a little bit unique in our genre is that thrillers, the modern covert ops and military thrillers, espionage thrillers, they tend to be very, very plot driven. You know, the story is everything. And certainly we try to come up with compelling stories and we can talk later about how important our antagonists are to our stories. But what we do that's a little different, I think, is that our stories are very character driven. And so when you resist, when someone like you, Bobby, says, oh, you know, I didn't want to turn the page too quick and miss something. It's not because you didn't want to miss the gore. You probably did want to miss that. But you feel like you'll miss a moment with John. You'll miss a moment with Lizzie. Mm-hmm. You won't know what she's up against. And so to me, that tells me we succeeded in our goal of bringing that character so to life for you that you don't want to abandon JD while he's in IK2. You want to make sure he's okay. You want to make sure that everything works out for him. So I think that is something that we do a little differently, writing very character driven. We try to bring the stakes for the character, but also those relationships between the characters, try to make those very, very real, that there's a consequence to the things that they're involved in those relationships and in the relationships at home. So that makes me feel wonderful to hear you say that, because my wife is one of those ones that does the la, 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 you know, when she's watching the movies or flip through a few pages. And if I can keep you reading every single word, despite the fact that it might be uncomfortable for you, then I think that Brian and I are doing a great job with the character stuff. So I hope that's the case anyway.
Well, and I know this is action, and there's action and action and action, but you also give us a chance to breathe. And I think that's another really important, an important thing as a reader is, okay, here's what's happened. Here's where this is and that is, and that one didn't make it out. Okay, I can settle back for a moment before you take me on a ride again. And I think as readers, we love that.
So yeah, I think, you know, it's wonderful for us to hear that, because, you know, like you said, you read a book a week. So you're reading 50 books a year. And so that you have a lot of benchmarks to compare it to. So we appreciate the feedback and the fact that, you know, what we're doing is resonating with you. And in Dempsey, you know, for example, one of the interesting things that we set out to do is we were telling two stories, you know, at the same time. So you had Jake's journey, you had Dempsey's journey, and they're very similar. And if you sort of pay attention as you're reading, you feel the same beats as you're going through the same emotions. And they're even thinking about each other sort of in these moments of great emotional stress. And physical stress. And so I'm just curious if that was something that you noticed when you were reading it.
I did. When Jake is introduced, because we're a little bit into the book when Jake is introduced, and my first thought was, he's in training. Okay, he's in SEAL training. Okay. And I'm looking at how many pages are left in the book, you know. And I'm thinking, well, will he actually be part of what I can begin to see is the, you know, where we're going, and how would that happen? Because he's just still in a very formative stage. But I also felt that the chapter, all of the different times that we visit with Jake through that week are really important because, again, for us that don't really know, here is a young man who's being formed into a SEAL. And that's what we know some of the other characters through that kind of a regimen, a discipline, turning ordinary into extraordinary. And so it gives us a little bit of a background. It gives us some way to understand, let's say, Dempsey, even though the two, at first we don't know what their relationship may or may not be. And I don't want to do spoiler alerts, but I appreciated that we had Jake and we had that time with him because I think it informed the storyline. And I thought of you as writers, like, oh, that's very clever that they did that. So they don't have to do a data dump on how you become a SEAL. You know, they're going to actually show us. And then, of course, we learn some more things. And I would imagine Jake is going to be very important in an upcoming book. And I'll be very interested to see sort of how that all, you know, plays out. Yeah. And you write wonderful women. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. For those strong women.
Strong women, that Elizabeth is dangerous.
Well, that's I will say, Bobby, that's a compliment also, but it's not a stretch because, you know, Brian and I have both served. We've served at the pointy tip of the spear in several different communities, and it's not gratuitous, it's not pandering to have a character like Lizzie, to have a character you know, in all of our books, really. In fact, Sandbox, the main protagonist, is a female CID officer turned homicide detective. And the reason that we do that, again, is not to be politically correct, not to be pandering, but because that's the reality of the world that we worked in. You know, I had the honor of serving in the JSOC community in a Tier 1 unit, and there were plenty of women there. There were no women SEALs, and there's still no women SEALs right now. But that doesn't mean that there aren't tons of women doing important jobs, whether it's as an 18 Delta combat medic or an intelligence analyst, like we have in Sons of Valor, all kinds of roles, helicopter pilots. And I worked with tons of CIA case officers who were women, who were superb. So the diversity that the country seems to be struggling to find has existed for decades in the military. And I think that it's important to remind people of that. The submarine force, and Brian can speak more to this, or I guess we both can now after spending time on the Indiana and getting to go aboard the USS Washington and talking to some of the female JOs. But the submarine force is fully integrated. Not all the boats yet, because there's not enough women to justify that. But the women that are aboard those boats, Brian, remember the JO that we talked to on the Blackfish?
Yeah, absolutely. They're female submarine officers. They're in the pipeline, female enlisted now, on point tip of the spear. You know, the captain, when we were underway on the Indiana, he said, you know, I got to say, the female Joes that we have, they're kicking the guy's ass. You know, they're kicking their asses. They're getting qualified faster. They're putting pressure on these guys. And the guys are feeling it. They're feeling behind. So, yeah. I mean,
my favorite thing, Brian, when we were on the Blackfish, and remember we asked, I can't remember her name, and I wouldn't say it if I did, but we asked that JO, hey, what's it like to be a woman on a submarine? And she literally laughed. She said, you know what? I don't think anybody on this boat thinks in those terms. And she pointed at her chest. She said, if you get dolphins, that's all that matters. The dolphin is the warfare pin of the submarine force. She said, if you're wearing dolphins, then what you're wearing is a symbol that you can save the lives of everybody on this boat when you're on the watch. She said, that's all my shipmates care about. They could not care less about anything else. And I thought that was awesome. I thought that was probably the most telling thing about the state of the force in terms of integration. So,
you know, I didn't do a lot of research. I just did a tiny bit. But Brian, you said you're on a attack submarine, you know, and I looked at there were Seawolves and Virginias and Los Angeles model. Which, were you on any one of those?
Yeah, I was on a Los Angeles class, gas attack. So traditionally, you know, we've sort of divided our modern submarine force into what we call the fast attack submarines or the hunter killers, and then the ballistic missile submarines that do you know, readiness patrols and nuclear deterrence. So the Ohio class was the name given to the ballistic missile submarines. It's based on the first ship in the flight. So, you know, that hull number of 750 goes to the, you know, Ohio, and I think the first 688 was the Los Angeles class. So that's how you get that hull number, or that name for Los Angeles class. Yeah. And now they've kind of messed it up. They're naming the Virginia classes. Some of them are cities, some of them are states, some of them are fish. So it's a little confusing. It used to be very clear. And then we have three other sort of, I wouldn't call them orphan submarines, but the Seawolf class, the Jimmy Carter, and the Connecticut. You know, those were big budget sort of Cold War project boats, very fast, a lot of armament, very expensive. And Congress sort of cut that program off at the knees after only, you know, three had been started, but they're quite formidable vessels and do some very interesting things out there.
We are talking with Brian Andrews and Jeff Wilson. They are the writing team. That's next week's thriller. Hold on. This is live. We don't edit. let me hold up the right one, Depsy. And we're going to talk more about this book when we come back after this short word about bookshop.org. We'll be right back. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with the Writer. Special guests, Brian Andrews and Jeff Wilson, and their book, Dempsey.
So yeah, I know you have some questions.
Let's talk about Dempsey.
Yeah, let's talk more about
Dempsey. We got a guy bigger than life.
Oh my gosh.
He can take on 10 men and survive. Not well, but
he's pretty amazing.
He's a tough guy. So
do you want to
inspired him? Did you have anybody out in the real world you know sort of like this guy, or you two just kind of put this fellow together?
I think that Dempsey is similar to all of the main characters, even the minor characters in all of our books, which is to say that they're all a nod to people that we've had the honor to serve with. John Dempsey is not a particular individual, but I think, Brian, would you agree? He's an amalgam of many people that we've served with. I think what resonates with us about Dempsey and his tie to the folks that we've had the pleasure of serving with is he represents the best of us in that he is not Superman. He gets hurt. He gets injured. He has physical limitations. I think it's pretty clear over the seven books he has some emotional and psychological limitations as well. But that's that ordinary man doing something so difficult is what makes them so extraordinary. To me, you know, when you watch the movies where the guy's bulletproof and he's the superhero and he jumps from building to building and rolls and doesn't even get a bruise. Okay, well, that's cool that you can do that, but what's the toll? What resonates with me about Dempsey is that in the character of Dempsey, you see the toll. You see the toll in his relationship. If you haven't read all the books, you may not know, but he's estranged from his wife. He's estranged from his son. He's divorced. They don't even know he's still alive. Mm-hmm. There's been an amazing, impactful toll that his commitment to his country and to his teammates has taken on him. And so I think that's what we try to reflect in Dempsey. Now, if you've watched CBS SEAL Team or some of these shows, one of the things that then they do that show very well, by the way, in terms of the action and the drama. But the thing that we don't like about it is it's a little bit of a caricature. It's a cartoon. Like they're all beat up. They all have PTSD. They're all drunks. They're all cheating on their wives. Like, I didn't know any guys like that. Like, you know, these guys are so ordinary. We have one of my teammates whenever we were in town, he was the assistant coach of his kids' little league team. That was his whole life. That's all he did. They, you know, get a phone call on the way home saying, can you pick up some milk? And they pick up milk on the way home and, you know, take care of their family. Most of them were in very stable family lives with wives who understood and supported them. So John, I think, shows the toll. And I think it was our attempt to show the reader what it takes to live that life and the toll that it can take.
I understand. I think we've seen in one of those SEAL shows, and maybe the one you kind of briefly mentioned, we don't watch it because we couldn't understand why everybody was dysfunctional, you know, in their private lives. If they're so dysfunctional in their private lives, how can they actually perform professionally?
Right.
So you kind of want to, besides, who wants to see our heroes totally blemished all the time? You know, if we got a story here, we want to see it go the right way. We want to ask a little process question here. Before I ask a couple questions about other characters, you know, how do you write together? You know, who writes about the one chapter and maybe the other wrote about another chapter? Well, how can you say that?
I do all the nouns.
I do all the verbs.
Brian writes all the verbs.
Good answer.
I mean, what's cool about our process is, you know, we sort of figured it out as we went along, but we were already writing in third person. We already both wrote multi-point of view novels. So for us to sort of continue that as a writing duo made a lot of sense because we already sort of outlined our books. You know, we're not outliners, we're more pantsers than we are plotters, but you know, we say, okay, in act one, you know, we've got the Dempsey POV, the Grimes POV, the Arcady POV, and we sort of Jarvis POV. And in this case, I think there were four major POVs, you know, through this book. Plus we had the Swede, but, you know, what it allows us to do is sort of break up, say, okay, well, I'm going to write a couple of chapters where Dempsey's doing this, and then I'd like to maybe write an Arcady chapter. And Jeff, great, I'd like to write these Jake chapters, and then I'm going to write Elizabeth. And as the book goes on, you know, what's kind of cool about the process is we both get excited to read what the other guy is working on, and we both get excited to write the other characters. So we don't hoard the characters. We sort of pass the book around and go back and forth, and we give each other an opportunity to spend some time in the heads of the different characters. And what that does is, through the process of us taking turns like that, is you start to get this one voice, you know, that starts to develop. It's kind of interesting. I can let Jeff speak a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I think that it sounds impossible. Yeah. And I think that what makes it work to be able to, you know, what Brian is saying is, not only are we splitting up points of view, but we're writing simultaneously. So if you're not an outliner, you can imagine that requires quite a bit of communication. It makes it sound like we're very slick, professional, together people, which we're not. We're actually more like 8-year-olds in the backyard.
Oh, that's the best.
That's fun.
That's the best.
It's a little bit more like getting on the phone and saying, dude, I just thought of the coolest thing. And then from there, we sort of build on each other. But I think that the one element that is really important to be able to write the way we do, to do this process that Brian described, it requires an enormous amount of trust in one another. It requires us to be on the same page, figuratively and literally. It requires getting rid of your ego. There can't be ownership of anything. And if you think about all those things together, you're sort of describing the life of someone who is a combat warrior in the military. You have to put your life in the hands of other people. They have to put their lives in yours. You have to get rid of your ego. You have to accept the fact that it takes a team to do anything. What you do individually is meaningless. You know, we use the expression team and mission before self in the military. That's a real thing. You can't survive. Like Brian likes to say, one dude can't drive a $6 billion submarine and one SEAL can't take down bin Laden. It takes a team. And if we apply that to writing, it makes it work. I think that our process wouldn't work for anybody that isn't able to sort of make that team and mission before. So it's like parenting, right, Brian? It's a lot like that.
Yeah. We look at our book, they're like our kids. So we would never say, I would never say, oh, this kid's my kid and the other one's my wife's kid or whatever. You wouldn't divide it up like that. So when we Yeah. We finish a book, we just want it to be the best damn book that it can be. It doesn't matter who wrote what word on what page. What matters is that we're both proud of it, and we both felt like we contributed to it and had a seat at the table, and that's how it's been for us.
And who edited what word, right? Like that's I think you know, you talk to writers all the time. You know the statement that all writing is editing, right? Mm-hmm. But when you're two people, each of us, one of the other things that Brian didn't mention was every chapter he writes, before it goes into the master file, I get it and I rewrite it.
And you rewrite it.
And vice versa. Every chapter, and there's no rules to that. There's no, hey, do you mind if I change this? Like, I read it, and if I'm like, it'll be better this way, I just do it. And he trusts that what I'm doing works, and vice versa. He doesn't call and say, can I change the third paragraph? He just does it. And I trust that if he changed it, it needed to be changed. So that putting the ego aside, I think, is the key for sure.
Do your characters ever surprise you?
They whisper to us all the time.
They whisper.
Ryan, how many times did Dempsey go, bro, I would no more do that. You got to rewrite that, man.
I think it's crazy that when you're writing dialogue, you really don't even know what they're going to say until they start to
say it. Until they say it. Yeah, it's true.
And that's surprised me that's how writing is for both of us, is that we a lot of times will set out on the chapter and we're like, well, it's just as fun for us to write as it is for maybe a reader to read it, because we don't know where it's going to go. The chapter.
Right. So, for sure you don't. Like, I always worry that the VA mental health people are going to hear me talking about it. And come take me away, because I'm like, dude, guess what Lizzie just told me? he knows it's fiction, right? That's not a real person.
So like back in book four, did you already know where book seven, like, did you envision all of this, the books in the series, or did you know when you were writing book six and you had a lot of cliffhangers from what I can understand that you knew how you would?
Book six, we thought would be the end of the trilogy. I don't know if we said this already, but we tend to write this series in three-book arcs. So Tier One, War Shadows and Crusader One, sort of our VBAC Persian arc, and then American Operator, Red Spectre, and Collateral was supposed to be the Russian arc. But like we were joking about just a second ago, like, we didn't know. The characters had more story to tell. It didn't wrap up at the end of Collateral. There were those threads left that we had to take care of business in Dempsey. And one of the reasons we named the book Dempsey, it wasn't meant to be a standalone, but it was meant to be sort of a very, you know, Dempsey forward book. And because we had to sort of do a part three and a half and, you know, four for that Russia arc, this book was unique for us in our storytelling journey.
And important in the series, because what I think Brian is implying is it's a real pivot. So for the people that have read books one through six, they know that there's an arc for Dempsey's care for all the characters. We try to keep our characters on a constant arc, but for Dempsey, our main character, that arc has always been going from the black and white world of naval special warfare to the shades of gray of a deep, dark, task force centric covert operation. And that's a difficult transition for people to make. Some people aren't successful at it. And so that's his arc. And in Dempsey, like Brian is saying, the reason we named it Dempsey is not because we want it to be just about him, but because it does reflect a transition point for this character that's going to inform what happens in the upcoming book. We're working on book eight right now. And the relationships are all going to change as a result of the experience that he had in Russia. So it really was a pivotal book in the series, where there's one, that last piece clicks for Dempsey making that slow evolution from Navy SEAL to covert operator, I guess. Mm-hmm.
So they just mentioned Russia. He just opened the door. Do you want to?
The Russian.
You want to run through that door?
We could talk all night. You know, two things. What? First, you know, I noticed, and you bring out in the book, the Russians, particularly maybe at a high political level or high military level, think different than it appears that they think different than we do. At least I do. People in this country think they have a sort of a different philosophy that you kind of bring out, and Are you, you understand where I'm coming from?
It feels so timely.
When you try to look at your adversary, one of the biggest mistakes that you can make is to sort of project yourself into their shoes and think that they think and they're going to react like you.
Right.
And as Americans, especially in our generation, we are very much raised with this idea that there's a win-win solution for every conflict. Right. I mean, that's kind of a bread and butter American philosophy, is that, you know what, we can all play this game. We can have the Super Bowl, but at the end of the day, you know, we can shake hands. We can celebrate together and accept our loss and accept our victory and blah, 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 blah. The Russian mentality is not like that. They don't believe in a win-win mentality. They're very zero-sum oriented politically and militarily. So if you're winning, it means by default they are losing. And, you know, we did a lot of research, talked to a number of people that had spent a lot of time in Russia. And, you know, it even goes so far as to say, you know, well, we'd rather burn the field down so nobody can play than, you know, walk away the losers and accept that defeat. And so for Dempsey, you know, part of that IK2 experience, and that's one of the reasons we wanted to open the book that way, is for him to understand that these are not the type of people that I'm used to dealing with. And I have to change my mentality if I'm going to survive here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's that was a huge element for Dempsey that we tried to write into the story, beginning actually all the way. That was an arc also, right? Beginning an American operator. And the other side of that, the more, I guess, tactical side of that, we tried to share with the reader this concern that has been going on that mm-hmm. I think we're getting ahead of now in the military and in our intelligence community. We spent literally two decades. That's an entire generation of operators who know nothing or who had no experience, I should say, outside of fighting terrorism. And mm-hmm. so you take a character like Dempsey, who in our universe became a SEAL probably just before 9/11 and has been fighting that war for 20 years. And now out of the blue, you want him to be engaged with a very Western thinking society, but like Brian is saying, a Western thinking society who thinks radically different than us. So they have, you know, we did a lot in the books leading up to this with that, you know, losing the asymmetry. You know, when you're fighting the Taliban in the Hindu Kush, you're by and large fighting guys who are goat herders, and yeah, they're well armed and they're ruthless, but they don't have fighter jets and they don't have tanks. And well, I guess they have them now because we left them there. But before that, when we were there, they didn't have. It was a very asymmetric war. Yeah. So to pivot from that to fighting an adversary that has a space program and has satellites and drones and fighters and submarines is very jarring for these men and women who were 20 years old when 9/11 happened and spent an entire career fighting that asymmetric battle. Now they're faced with an enemy like China or an enemy like Russia, and it's jarring. Yeah. And there's a catch-up phase of getting ahead of that, I think. Mm-hmm. So in addition to everything Brian said, I think we tried to reflect a little bit of that discomfort for our characters.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to ask a question about Alexei. He's the activist, the dissident that's in prison that we want to get out. But a question on the storyline, because I'm talking to Bobby the other night, and I said, this story I'm reading out of the Wall Street Journal, it's not that long ago, about how they finally, I followed a lot about
we
this.
We couldn't remember his name.
And he had a big following, and then he gets poisoned, which doesn't surprise you, because that seems to be a kind of technique that the Russian folks like to use. Then he's in hospital, and you know they're probably going to poison him again because he's not dead yet. And then his friends will get him out and take him. He ends up in Germany.
Yeah.
And then he gets saved.
Yeah.
Next thing I know, he's back in Russia. Yeah. And he's in prison.
And that real
did this
person,
happen before you wrote the book, or did you tell really? The future wrote this first?
I mean, I think it's, you know, we have these thinly veiled avatars, you know, in the story for a reason, you know, with Petrov, being and Alexei Nerozov being Alexei Navalny, you know. And so, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things we were sort of thinking about, and we thought that everybody would be shocked. I mean, we thought there would be there's so much discussion and outrage and just sort of like, how dare they propose this? You know, with the Dempsey's mission, this book, we really thought would shock people. And the hilarious thing is it hasn't shocked anybody. Nobody says, oh my gosh, I can't believe what these guys just proposed. Everyone's like, yeah, it sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, it's like, we're like, okay, so when is that going to happen?
Yeah.
When is President Vladimir Putin going to go to the opera?
Exactly.
No spoiler alert, no spoiler alert, but when is he going to go to the opera?
Yeah, but I mean, it, you know, when we write these books, we're intellectually curious too. So it's important for us to, you know, we want to try to think about, well, how would you make this transition? How could it possibly happen? Because it hasn't happened yet, right? And it seems like an intractable problem. And who would Putin's successor be? You know, and Navalny, you know, if you've seen the documentary, it won the Oscar last year, but it's really telling to see, you know, what he put himself through and the amount of courage that this man has to go back to Russia, knowing that he's going to be put into prison or potentially, you know, successfully murdered again. And that's the sort of patriotism that he has. And so we felt like it was important to represent that in the pages of this story and sort of imagine that, you know, he could potentially be the heir apparent and maybe harbor in a brighter future in Russia.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know you have more questions.
You know, I think that we could probably, the average American would probably learn a few things just by reading this book. Not necessarily, you know, we're not even talking about enjoying a good read. It's just, I don't think that we talk about these days about how the Russians really think. We're familiar with Olympics and we're familiar with athletics and that sort of thing. Sort of thing goes on, but I don't think we really understand the way that the political folks.
Well, and that's this story informs that. And I think, you know, when we just get the bits and pieces in the news and it depends on who you're watching and when you're watching, here's like, just read this and you'll understand the whole thing that's happening. And it's much more entertaining.
I want to ask a SEAL question. Did you go through all that?
No, neither one of us are SEALs. I worked in the SEAL teams. I like to tell people that the way I did it was sort of like going to graduate school before graduating from high school. Because I've never been to Buzz. I don't wear a trident. I don't pretend to understand how difficult that would have been. But what I did do was when I got recruited to go over to this unit, I had to go through what's called green team selection. And so I basically did the advanced training alongside of a lot of SEALs, having not been through SEAL training. So it was grueling, but not anything like what occurs in BUDS. Certainly I learned a ton and I was humbled in a lot of ways very frequently. But no, I am not a SEAL and have not been through BUDS.
You know, as we understand the philosophy of a SEAL, and we didn't quite understand it as you go through the training, whether you make it or not, and like maybe 23-25% of the folks, you know, actually go through the whole program, but that there's not failure here. It's just that you decide whether you're going to make it or you decide you're going to drop out because it's not quite your program. But there's no failure attached. Is that the way? Do I understand that correctly?
That's right. I mean, you can. I mean, there are certain key evolutions that if you fail, you're done. If you can't complete dive training, if you can't do these things, but with a few exceptions, people elect to leave SEAL training because it's just not for them. And you know, that's been a challenge for the Navy, is to try to find what's that secret sauce. What is it? How can we select people? Because it's very expensive. Yeah. You said, 23% or so, 25%, sometimes as much as 30%, but that's just BUDS. If you take everybody that selects for SEAL training, take 100 guys, 10 people will make it through the end. 10. Okay. So 10%. Through, if you look at buds, it is about a 70% attrition. But there are other places where people cannot make it through. So the Navy's been very interested in saying, well, let's do better. Like, we have a team of psychologists and physicians and sports medicine people and all kinds of people. Let's figure out that secret sauce and select people so that we can improve our success rate. And they spent millions of dollars and several years, and they set up a pre-BUDS training program, and they're like, okay, now we've got it figured out. And after the end of all of that, the attrition rate from BUDS is about 70%, and the overall attrition rate is about 90%. And having worked beside these men, I can tell you that it's because there is no way to determine who has the heart to do it, because that's the only difference between the guy that makes it and doesn't. If it's something that you can't fail out of, that you have to choose to leave, how do you select the guy who simply refuses to leave? Because you're basically trying to screen something that guy doesn't know about himself until he knows. You don't know until you know. There are techniques that we hear. We've talked to our friends and teammates who have been through this, and they say, you know, there's some keys that all these guys have in common. Like, one of them is they're able to look at things microscopically. They say, okay, I don't have to make it through 5 days of Hell Week. I have to make it through the next hour.
That's Jake.
There's an hour. Okay, I'll make it through the next hour. I'll make it through this evolution. Not thinking about what comes. Okay, I'm going to make it through the flutter kicks and the surf. If I make it through that, then I make it through that. Okay, I made it through that. All right, I'm going to make it through the next running around with the telephone pole on my head to go to the towel. I'll make it through that. And so that ability to compartmentalize and say, I'm going to focus on a single task, complete it. That's one thing that predicts success. The other thing that predicts success that I'm trying to instill into my son, I'm up here in Annapolis right now. My son's getting ready to do a sailing camp at the Naval Academy because he wants to attend the Naval Academy. The other thing that predicts success is your ability to put somebody and something ahead of yourself. The guys that go there because they want to be a SEAL don't make it. The guys that are there because they want to be part of something bigger than themselves, they make it. And the guy that reaches up and helps the guy next to him, they make it. They understand that there's something bigger than
them. You should read the quote. I'm looking at our clock, and oh my goodness, it's running out. Jim has a quote that talks right to this. Would you do your quote now so that we don't run out of time?
We want to make sure we get this in.
Yes, we want to be sure. Jim always gets a quote.
I like to get one from the book, and then maybe somebody from some famous writer from days gone by.
Okay, we have to get to it, sweetie.
But we're just one quote tonight, right from the book. It's from a retired Naval SEAL commander who is given direction to one of our characters. And he says, "The life is hard, Jake, but it's a calling. You have to know your why or you'll never get past Hell Week. You can't do it for anyone else because, honestly, it's just too damn hard. Your old man was a legend, but he would tell you the same thing. If there is something else you can do and be happy, something not being a SEAL, then go do that instead." I thought it was very apropos for anybody.
That is from the book Dempsey. We are so delighted that we had Brian and Jeff with us tonight. We'll just stay on the line, gentlemen. We are going to kind of wrap the show because we are counting down. Thank you so much for being with us. Very quickly, where can people find you and get your books? Very quickly.
Our website is www.anders-wilson.com. And if you go there, you can sign up for our newsletter. We promise not to spam you. We only send a couple a year. Just keep you apprised of our events, new releases and the like. So yeah, please sign up for the newsletter. And if you do, you can have a free book, which is Scars. It's a novella about John Dempsey's sort of origin story. So that's
I better do that. Our guest next week is a writer coming back for a second time. We have Frank Weber with us. And it is The Haunted House of Hillman. He's a fabulous crime, true crime thriller writer. I started it last night and I didn't sleep a wink and had to keep the lights on. So join us for this next week. And on behalf of...
Remember, LS, remember, which I don't always remember, it's always a great day out west.
See you next week. Thank you.
You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell.